Today we continue with part two of our interview with Steve Johnson on witnessing and holding beauty in photography. If you missed part one, check out last week's podcast. You're listening to the 7 Photography Questions podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. Audrey Lanford. We're easy to find on the web at www.7photographyquestions.com. Today's show is sponsored by SecretsOfMasterPhotographers.com. Today, Steve will be finished answering the rest of the biggest questions about witnessing and holding beauty in photography. He'll also show us and tell us some of the stories behind some of his photographs. So check out the show notes from last week to see Steve's photographs, which we'll discuss in a little while. Okay, let's continue. So here's the, and this one is kind of a, it's almost a continuation, I think, of also what we've been talking about. It certainly was the most common question we got this week. I go through periods where I frankly feel stuck. I don't know what to shoot, and it seems like I don't capture the beauty of what I'm photographing, which means that I'm forever disappointed with my shots. Are there any tools, of course, beyond what we've already talked about, that can help me? Can you give me a few suggestions that I can use next time to help me get unstuck and perhaps help me be more happy with the shots? I'd be interested in anything different that you might suggest. Thank you.
Well, creativity loves play. And if you're stuck, maybe it's time to goof around photographically a bit and just try things you've never tried, something that you were curious about, or something that you react to in some way, but you've never actually sat down and tried to photograph. And this just happened to me recently because we're all quite well aware of Weston's peppers and cabbage and nautilus shells and things like that, where ordinary things of beauty were made into rather extraordinary photographs. And I was making a salad one day and looking at just the beauty of one of the onions I had sliced in terms of form, and I said, well, darn, I'm going to go ahead and just go to the store, buy some really neat-looking veggies and just put them on the, you know, dark background and photograph them. So I brought it in the studio, got out the studio lights, and was sort of messing around with the dark background and made a few. And they were, you know, some of them were kind of nice, and one pair was particularly nice. And I thought, you know, the black background seems contrived. I think I'll just go ahead and put up the light table and just float the whole thing in light. And I did that for a few of them, and I thought, oh, this is pretty nice. I like this. And then, you know, I gathered a bunch of them together, and you know, it was okay, but it sort of came out a bit like a cornucopia, and that really wasn't what I intended, but it was all fine. And what it did was it just stirred up the notion of still life. It stirred up looking at all of these sort of precious objects that I've collected over the years and thinking about how I might want to photograph them instead of just being sort of a dust collector on a shelf at home. And it made me think about all of that natural form that is intimately around me that I rarely photograph, that really I have to pay more attention to. And so I just went through this, you know, sort of the very heart of the question. It's not that I was stuck so much as I had a lot of work to do around here for quite a few weeks. I'd been on the road for months and months and months making photographs and hadn't really had a chance to be at home and think about photography. And so I ended up even writing the column in my last newsletter about this very thing. And so that's sjphoto.com, and you can get to the newsletter from the homepage. And so I put that cornucopia in, I put the pear in, and I just talked about the process of play. And like I said, creativity loves play. So goof around. Try something goofy. Try something you've never tried before. Erecting projects, whether or not they're of deep interest, can sometimes be a way of working through it. I know one of the things that I used to do in beginning photography classes way back in the 70s and early 80s when I taught those classes was I would try and give people an assignment that forced them into a small, confined space and forced them to look and see things that they had never noticed as photographic possibilities. And one of the variations on that assignment was to go into your bathroom, or for that matter, any bathroom, but preferably yours, because you sit there once in a while and look around, and you think you know it. And yet at the same time, if I say, go into that room and expose a whole roll of film, another metaphor that doesn't quite work anymore, you'll force yourself to see things and see relationships and see shapes and forms in ways that you might never have seen them before. And those kinds of things can be very handy. We get this notion that we have to go to some exotic place in order to make photographs, when sometimes around our daily lives are some of the most extraordinary images just sitting there waiting to be held. And I think maybe ultimately we bring far more power to the things we're intimate with than the things that are exotic to us. I remember a quote from William Saroyan, the Armenian writer, who, like many people in the early part of the 19th century, went to Paris to try and learn to write and hang out in the cafes. And he wrote some things, and they were okay. But when he came back to his homeland in Fresno, in the Central Valley in California, and started writing about his family and friends and the life experiences that he actually knew well, that's when he wrote great literature. And I think sometimes as photographers, we get so seduced by the exotic that we fail to see the ordinary. And in the ordinary is probably the greatest power, far less power oftentimes than the exotic.
I love it. Thank you. So let's take our second break now. I want to just remind everybody listening who hasn't yet done so to sign up for our free email mini course called Secrets of Master Photographers. Each week in the mini course, I share one digital photography tip, technique, or even secret from a photographer that can make a difference between having just boring pictures and those that you really like. Plus, you'll get the inside scoop on how exactly you can ask the photographers I interview each week your biggest photography questions. So just go sign up for free at www.secretsofmasterphotographers.com. We'll include the link in the show notes. So Steve, now can you share a couple of your, and I put this in quotes, secrets for witnessing and holding beauty in photography? And we were talking about this before we started. I know you don't really believe in secrets, but somehow I think some of our listeners might think of what you say in that light. But in any case, however you look at it, some tips that would be beneficial to our listeners.
Well, there's probably nothing that I could really add to the things I've already said with regards to paying attention to what you're really grabbing the camera for and try and make that the subject matter of the photograph. But I suppose one way of answering it would be to think through the things that trip me up and then maybe share that with people to maybe help them not be tripped up by some of the same things. And one of those things that trips me up is sometimes this sense that I'm supposed to be photographing. You know, there is enormous value in wandering. My friend Dave Bone, who wrote a beautiful book about Glacier Bay for the Sierra Club in the mid-60s, has said that the wandering is the experience that the photograph tries to imitate. It's not his exact words, but that gets at it. By the way, that's B-O-H-N for those of you that need to go out and buy that book or some of Dave's other books. The sense that there's an agenda rather than just the experience, I think, is something that I continually struggle with. I don't want to be out wandering the planet thinking I'm supposed to be making photographs. I want to make photographs for the sheer joy of making them. And sometimes when I feel that, I haven't made a photograph for a couple of hours and I've been on this trail, and somehow or another feel like I've failed somehow, and at the same time I've had this wonderful natural experience of just enjoying the trees and the wind and the sound of the birds, That's something I have to fight back. And also the kind of challenge it sometimes is to give your full commitment to what you're doing at that particular moment. I mean, if, for example, if people are making love and their mind is someplace else, they probably ought not to be making love. You know, it sort of should really kind of fill your attention. Well, in that same sense, I think that oftentimes when we're photographing, we're almost doing it incidentally rather than in full concentration. And sometimes that's because we've seen something that we're moderately interested in, but we see something else down the trail, which may also, you know, relate back to making love. You know, people get distracted by other people. But that idea of trying to give yourself fully to the moment and the experience that you're engaged in at that time. And that can help prevent all sorts of technical mistakes, as well as a casualness to the photograph that might call for a great deal of intensity. And I think at some level that has to do with a sense that I grew up with for one reason or another, that if it's worth doing, it's worth doing well. And if it's worth doing well, it often is going to take a fair amount of real attention toward doing it, which is one of the reasons that I'm not particularly fond of people making hundreds and hundreds of photographs in a day rather than a select few. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm not also guilty of that. If as I'm going to be heading to Antarctica in January again, and you're out on the edge of the boat and watching a field of icebergs float by just full of sensuous and intriguing form, yeah, you're probably going to make hundreds of photographs because the scene is constantly changing and you're completely drawn into it. But that's almost the kind of sports photography where things are moving so fast that you're trying to capture not the action that you might be in a sports photograph, but the compositional intrigue and design that you're only getting a moment to see.
Mm-hmm.
And in that kind of a situation, it's also true that you end up often seeing the world through a viewfinder rather than with your eyes. And so there does tend to be a competition between just enjoying what you're seeing and photographing, or trying to find a balance so that you take the camera away from your eyes and enjoy it, and then bring it back. So you try and give co-equal time to your soul and your craft. And it's not as though there isn't soul in the act of making a photograph, but there's probably even greater soul when you can see the image outside of the confines of a photo camera's viewfinder. So I guess those would be two things that I would think about, is give yourself fully to that moment and at the same time allow yourself to still experience the scene as a human.
Not too long ago, we were watching fireworks, and I had decided that I'd never photographed fireworks before, and I thought it would be really fun to try to photograph fireworks. And it was that exactly what you were describing, this constant duality between having my, because it didn't last long. I mean, it was, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of having the fireworks going off, and probably not as dramatic as Antarctica, but nonetheless, and trying to have that experience of actually watching, you know, the awe of the fireworks and at the same time trying to capture it and, you know, doing some part of the time and doing some part of the time. It was sort of exactly an example of what you were just saying.
Yeah, well, fireworks is one of those absolutely seductive things not to take your eyes off.
Right.
And so in that sense, if you want to try and photograph the fireworks, it's almost as though you've got to give yourself one way or another to the either the experience or the photographs. And you're torn at that point. So
yeah.
Usually when I'm photographing fireworks, I allow them to be part of a larger scene so I can literally set the camera up and just fire it when I want, yet still stand there and watch the photographs. Boy, that was ridiculous.
That's pretty cool.
Stand there and watch the real world.
Right, right.
And
I love it.
You know, you don't get the abstract things you might get zoomed in on a particular burst, but you do sometimes get a passage of both time and movement that is really quite extraordinary.
So let's spend now a few minutes talking about the photographs that you sent me. I'd love you to tell some of the stories behind them. And just a quick caveat for our listeners, as always, if you are not listening to this while you're driving, then you can go out and check the show notes out now and see Steve's photographs as we talk about them and follow along at www.7photographyquestions.com. Otherwise, please come back and listen to the section again when you're back at your computer, because obviously you don't want to do that while you're driving. So, Steve, let's start with the first one.
Well, we have a photograph of what most people know as Mount McKinley, but is really Denali from Denali National Park, the tallest photograph. Boy, again, a lot of
twice.
Freudian slips here in terms of prejudice of thinking. The tallest mountain in Alaska, I think actually the tallest mountain in North America, if I'm not mistaken. The photograph of it was made from a place called Wonder Lake, a place many of us know from landscape photography, with Ansel Adams' rather magnificent photograph from the north side of Wonder Lake, looking across the reflectivity out to Denali out in the distance. And it's a very beautiful mountain. The photograph in this particular case was made with a very long lens, because I'm almost 25 miles away from the mountain. And it's just always been a real favorite of mine for a number of reasons. And, of course, not the least of which is the experience of making the photograph, because many people go to Denali National Park and never see the mountain because it's shrouded in clouds oftentimes, as it had been that whole first day that my wife Mary and I, or at least my ex-wife Mary and I, were there and enjoying the place very much, but we hadn't seen the mountain. Late in the afternoon, which in Alaska in the summertime means, 8 or 9 p.m. in the evening, the clouds cleared and the mountain just opened up, and there it was, just glowing out on the horizon. And we were on the south end of the campground there, with most of the campground behind us. And it was just completely entrancing, the light coming from the west, striking the mountain, allowing this line to climb up the side of the mountain between shadow and highlight, between the west-facing and east-facing views of this mountain, looking toward the south at this just magnificent thing that just filled your head, even though it was so far away that it certainly didn't fill your eyes as big as it is. We later realized from some of the people that were at the other end of the campground that people were so entranced that they didn't even notice a small herd of caribou that went right through the campground, because people were looking at the mountain and not noticing anything else around them. And so the experience of making the photograph, seeing Denali for the first time, being able to reach out to it with the longer lens, and then make a black and white photograph of it that really did rise to a lot of my goals with respect to a kind of glow and sharpness that I've always looked for in black and white work, as well as a suggestion of abstraction, was something that very pleased me very much. Do you want me to just go through the others?
Sure.
And just talk about them. The next one, in both time and experience, was a photograph of just a little piece of tree fungus I found in Yosemite Valley one day, and actually on a photography workshop I was teaching when we were walking along the trail to Mirror Lake. And as I always try and do when I'm teaching a workshop, as I notice things, I try and point them out to people. And, you know, that could be fallen bark, it could be the gesture of a branch, it could be marks in the granite walls, it could be almost anything. Well, in this particular case, this tiny little piece of tree fungus, it was probably no more than about 4 inches tall, was just incredibly beautiful in the shaded side of this fallen log. And so we took the time on the workshop to lower the tripods right next to the ground, really try and fill the frame with this rather beautiful, sensual form, and make photographs. And in that case, I remember talking through the zone system, because this was a film-based shot, and talking about simplicity and trying to make the photograph about only what you wanted it to be about. And I think this particular piece of fungus ended up working out in almost all those ways for me. And when they do, those photographs tend to become favorites, especially if they end up having some intrinsic beauty that tends to stay with you. Beyond that, we're getting into some of the large format digital work that I've been doing since 1994 with the 4x5 scanning back that Mike Collette built in 93. And I started using, in late 93, but Mike built a second camera for me in mid-spring. And I was so stunned by the image quality, both in terms of color accuracy, detail, resolution, dynamic range, that these 140 megapixel photographs I was making in 1994 kind of impressed me. And I felt that the only way I could really react to what this newfound, incredibly capable digital camera system could deliver was to dream up some ambitious project to throw myself into to see if it was realistic to actually photograph with a back that at that point took almost 4 minutes to make a single photograph as the sensor scanned across the back of the 4x5 viewing area. So I dreamed up this project on the national parks that I call With a New Eye and proceeded to embark on that project. We had a joint press conference with the Ansel Adams Gallery in June of 94 in Yosemite Valley, announced this project to the public and started raising money for it. And I originally had in mind about 8 to 12 parks, and I ended up doing 52 over 10 years.
Wow.
And I think it was partly the seduction, partly the fact that I was raising a family at the time and had lots of stuff to do at the same time as I was doing the project, but it became a long-term look at a subtler, more pastel, more intimate, and I think, in my own mind at least, honest view of these places. And really became a distillation of both my aesthetic and the potentials, I think, of digital photography. And so both the ice photograph from Kenai Fjords National Park and the travertine photograph of Mammoth at Yellowstone are both good examples of, I think, the kind of simplicity of form that I've been talking about during the course of this interview, of trying to distill the scene down to the essential qualities, trying to really concentrate on both sensuality and design. And at the same time, because both of these are color photographs, having the color play an important role in the appreciation of the work. You know, we see in color, and because we do, any color photograph automatically has to overcome a kind of facade of the ordinary to rise out of normal human experience, out of being a mere snapshot into something a little bit more profound, perhaps. And it's often true that people photograph in color when the color is playing no positive role for the photograph. And if you have ask yourself that question and you can't answer that the color is positively contributing to the photograph, it probably should be a black and white, so that you take advantage of black and white's greater inherent abstract nature and you dispose of the color that isn't helping the photograph. Admittedly, it takes it further away from your human experience, but it plays into one of photography's origins, as well as one of its abstract strengths, this monochrome rendition that we've all become quite fond of. The Kenai Fjords photograph was the second day at the Exit Glacier, and my assistant Darren Steinberg and I had climbed up what we had the goal of being toward the top of the trail up toward the Harding Ice Field, but made it only about a fourth to a third of the way up and realized we couldn't go any further, and had just a magnificent day. And this is just a simple little photograph walking along a paved trail, or at least a dirt trail, along the leading edge of the melting glacier. And so it was an extremely simple photograph to make, especially as compared to all the effort we put out the previous day. But those two photographs from that trip stand out, one from looking down on the glacier from above and looking up toward the glacier from below. And completely different photographs, and yet at the same time, they reach toward a level of simplicity and awe that I felt really positively about. The photograph of Mammoth from Yellowstone with the trees and the travertine is, again, a place that I'd photographed both with film and with my digital camera, and had made a lot of perfectly okay photographs of. But I had actually gone back to have lunch with my family, quit, packed up all the cameras, and was driving away when I noticed these trees up on this little side trail sticking out of the travertine, and very nicely asked my wife, Mary, if she couldn't occupy the kids for a little while longer, and she generously said yes. And I walked up this little side trail, and I was just completely taken by this small vertical components of the now dead trees and this kind of layered diagonal of the travertine having formed, flowing down from the springs above. And again, it created kind of a simplicity of form and sensuality that I was quite struck by. The other photograph that's in this particular set is a kind of a swirl of rocks from the Valley of Fire. This happens to be made with my Canon digital single lens reflex, so it's the only 35 format among this particular set, but of course gives you this enormous freedom to wander and see things without quite the formal setup of the larger cameras. And I was so taken with this creek bed, with both the swirls of sand and this beautiful eroded form in the sandstone, that if any of these have that component of sensuality that I was talking about earlier in the interview, I think this one might in a very easy to discern way. It was a remarkable place that I think I could easily spend days and days working, because the form was so intricate, so sensual, so flesh-like in color as well, and to have an added human dynamic that I was quite taken with. So that's some comments about each of those. I hope it's useful to people that have time to go out and look at them.
Well, thank you so much. Absolutely. That really was, when you originally sent me the fungus picture, I looked at it, and it's funny because it's the subject matter is obviously so different, but it really had, the first thing I thought about was the similarities between the Weston peppers. I mean, it was a completely different and in its, you know, completely it more complex and yet very simple, just beautiful image. So it was sort of interesting that you mentioned that earlier as well. So thank you so much for sharing all of these. I think our listeners, I know our listeners got a lot out of that. I certainly did. Finally, our last question is, could you just share one or two exercises that perhaps, I think you've actually kind of done this already, but I'll ask anyway, that our listeners can do to improve their photographs based on what we've already talked about today?
The simplest thing, I think, is to force yourself to see a single thing, to really try and go through the exercise of excluding everything that doesn't strengthen the image, and to be very aggressive about that exclusion, so that you get a good idea of what simple might mean to you. That's probably the single best piece of advice I could give to anybody with regards to composition. And then, again, referencing something I said earlier in the conversation with regards to force yourself to see the world you know. Force yourself to see the visual possibilities in very ordinary circumstances that you think you know well, but perhaps are no longer seeing. One of the reasons we go away from home to photograph is we don't think there's anything in our homes to photograph. And I don't mean house, literally. I mean our general, normal living environments, our local towns or whatever. And some of us are very lucky to live in places we find very beautiful. I happen to live right on the Pacific Ocean, about a half mile up from the beach, and so I've got lots of natural scenery around me that I really do appreciate. But we all take those things for granted, and they become visually familiar to the extent that we often don't see them anymore. And sometimes it's very useful to force yourself to go among the most ordinary and familiar circumstances and try and see them anew. And the other thing that I would say is, going back to that idea when you ask about being stuck, as to whether or not you could find yourself some photographic play to engage in. And I don't mean a technical gimmick. I mean play with subject matter and the manner in which you photograph it. not really a fan of things like lens babies or other sorts of intentional distortions. But then again, people have a lot of fun and break some doldrums by buying a plastic Diana camera or a Holga camera and going out and making really funky film-based photographs. I mean, whatever shakes it up for you, and some people do find that things like that focus distortion tool of the lens baby is one thing that people like. Personally, I'm trying to get people to shake up their seeing more than their craft. And so it's I think it's about trying to figure out the things you're not comfortable doing and forcing yourself to do them, or are unfamiliar with doing and forcing yourself to try.
So, Steve, as always, we've talked about a lot of stuff today. If you had to pick one thing that you most want our listeners to remember based on today's interview that you think would make the biggest difference in their photography, what, and if it were me, it would be hard to pick, but if you were going to pick that one thing, what would it be?
Keep it simple.
I suspected you were going to say that. Great.
And be aware in this age of Photoshop that photographs do have a bit of the sacred attached to them in terms of being that held moment of things that were actually before the lens. And let that sort of be at least my particular suggestion on a guide with regards to Photoshop work after the fact. Yeah, you don't edit a mediocre photograph into a strong photograph in Photoshop, and you end up wasting a lot of time when you try. I think you finish a photograph that you made that had strength to begin with in Photoshop and can have strength by finishing it clearly and with craft in Photoshop. But the photograph is made in the camera, and that's where I would encourage people to spend the bulk of their time.
So, listeners, now it's your turn. Could you please go to the 7photographyquestions.com website and post your comments on your big insight, the thing you've gotten the most out of from today's interview, as well as any questions you may have. You can do that now or when you're back at your computer. And also, if you haven't yet signed up for our early email notification list, I recommend you do that when you're at the website as well. So, Steve, thank you so much. If people want to learn more about all the different things you offer, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, the website is sjphoto.com. And the workshops that I teach, both in my digital photo lab here that I've built near San Francisco, are in there, as well as the field workshops that I do around the West mostly, but international workshops as well. So it's from Death Valley to the Galapagos to Ireland to Iceland to Yosemite and the California coast to Maine, so all over the place. And also there's a products a button there as well that leads you to the books, like my most recent book, the Stephen Johnson on Digital Photography, published by O'Reilly. And the National Parks book that you mentioned earlier isn't out yet. We're still working on bringing that to publication.
Huh.
But that hopefully will be sometime in 2009. Okay. But the other books are there, including mostly, including special editions of those books that often come in a box case and with a limited edition print as well. So all four of the current books in publication are up there, and hopefully the fifth will be up there before too long.
Great. We'll include specific links to all of that in the show notes. And I would like to highly encourage everybody to go check out your website at sjphoto.com. There is just so much wonderful material you can really get lost on your site. So it's just a great site. So
thank you very much.
So thanks again. This has really been so appreciated.
Thanks very much. I appreciate your interest in my work.
So listeners, you've been listening to the 7 Photography Questions podcast at www.7photographyquestions.com. If you're a subscriber to our series, we want to thank you for being one. And if you'd like to be automatically updated with new interviews as they're released, we encourage you to subscribe to this interview series via podcast. In fact, we'd really appreciate if you subscribe via iTunes regardless of how you listen. You can find the subscription options at www.7photographyquestions.com. I'm Audrey Lanford, and thanks so much for listening.